had a crazy morning. This is Cliff, your host of Earth Ancients, startling new discoveries from our planet's distant past. And I apologize for starting late this morning. We have had technical difficulties getting into the studio. The studio was not functioning. The studio is in New York. I'm calling you from Oakland. And so it's been a bit of a delay. We're over our time by 15 minutes. But I've been assured that we can have our full hour, and they actually tacked on some more time, so we're going to have a good show here. This has been Giant Week, Giants, and it's basically a prelude to our guest today, Richard Dewhurst. And when I say all things giant, I have been posting quite a bit of information from his book. The book's title is The Ancient Giants Who Ruled America, The Missing Skeletons and the Great Smithsonian Cover-Up. And what's fascinating about this book is that I had no clue that giants actually, you know, I always thought there was a, you know, giant here, giant there, and of course the biblical giants and the mythological giants have always been in our consciousness. Giants are everywhere. It seems like there's giants in Europe and there's giants in South America and Mexico. People are emailing me photographs of skeletons that they've found in different parts of the world. It's just fascinating. It's just amazing. In fact, I did a little research yesterday on Goliath, the famous biblical David and Goliath. And I found an article that came out, I think it was in 2008. It's been a while. But Israeli archaeologists unearthed proof that David, who became king of Jerusalem, actually existed and that he did fight a Goliath. So it's quite fascinating. I actually posted that, so do take a look at it. So let me get a hold of Richard here, and then I'll introduce him, and we can move forward with our interview today. I called him earlier, and we will quickly dial, and there we go. So this is going to be very, very interesting today because his book is – hey, Richard. Hi, this is Cliff.
Oh, Cliff. Hi, how are you?
Hi. Great. So
yeah.
We've had technical difficulties for the last 15 minutes. We're live now. And I've been just talking about – this has been All Things Giant Week since I have been doing a little research on my own, and I posted up some articles on my Facebook page. But so anyhow – welcome to the show, and I want to kind of lead in a little bit. The Ancient Giants Who Ruled America, The Missing Skeletons, and the Great Smithsonian Cover-Up. And this is what the publisher actually said about the book. Drawing on 400 years of newspaper articles and photos, first-person accounts, state historical records, and illustrated field reports, Richard Dewhurst reveals not only that North America was once ruled by an advanced race of giants, but also that the Smithsonian has been actively suppressing the physical evidence for nearly 150 years. He shows how thousands of giant skeletons have been unearthed at mound builder sites across the continent, only to disappear from the historical record. He examines other concealed giant discoveries, such as the giant mummies found in Spirit Cave, Nevada, wrapped in fine textiles and dating to 8,000 BC, the hundreds of long-haired bog mummies found in sinkhole and cenotes on the west coast of Florida, dating to around 7,500 BC, and the ruins of the giant cities which populated in excess of 100,000 people in Arizona, Oklahoma, Alabama, and Louisiana. So Richard, you're an Emmy Award-winning writer of the HBO feature documentary Dear America, Letters Home from Vietnam. You're a graduate of NYU with degrees in journalism, film, and television, and you've written and edited for the History Channel, Arts and Entertainment Channel, PBS, Fox Television, and Fox Films, ABC News, TNT, Paramount Pictures, and the Miami Herald. So tell me about this book. It's a fascinating book. In the introduction, you describe uncovering the real history of America and how you had to basically rethink everything you were taught in school. Can you tell us a little bit of your discovery of the giants? I know in the beginning of the book you kind of say that, you know, because you're a very, very tall person, I think you said you're 6'6", that you kind of were interested in, you know, you're a tall person. Are there giants in the world? Tell us a little bit about the inception of your discovery.
You know, just as part of, you know, natural process of being around 6'6", I developed a fascination with giant stories over the years. And as a journalist and documentary filmmaker, I would run across references and mostly nubs to articles that had supposedly appeared over the years. And so I began to develop a file, and several years ago I was casting around for something, new project to do, and I thought, well, I'll look into this, you know. I had really not that many preconceptions about it, and so I subscribed to several online newspaper archive services, and first I began putting in the dates and the publications for the things that I had amassed, and I only found maybe 25% of what I was looking for, and then finally, one day, out of sheer frustration, I used the headline word search, and I started to think like an old newspaper editor, and I put in giant skeletons unearthed, you know, with no references to anything. And I got about 30 hits for various newspapers over the last 200 years, and that's what really started me down the road. And as I began to get more luck with the word search, I began accumulating just an extraordinary amount of giant stories, eventually over 800 of them. And they include every state in the union, and go basically all the way up, mostly through the 1950s, at which point there's just a precipitous drop-off in all reporting altogether. I think one of the most surprising things I found was a quote by Abraham Lincoln. He was giving a speech in Niagara Falls in 1848 in which he said, "The eyes of that species of extinct giant whose bones fill the mounds of America have once gazed on Niagara as ours do now."
Oh, my God.
And, that one really threw me for a loop, you know. And I've had
that
some people question the quote and said, you know, he's really referring to mammoths and giant sloths. And I say to them, giants and mammoth sloths, their bones don't fill the mounds of America. Giant human skeletons' bones fill the mounds of America. And he clearly knew what he was talking about, because in the exact area where he's giving the speech in the 19th century, they found a huge city there. And not only did they find giant skeletons, they found remains of houses, metal forges, metal works that included gold and silver work, and 2 tons of charcoal. And then right south of there in Cayuga County, they found what they called the Cemetery of Giants, which included 250 skeletons, 7 to 9 feet. And a little farther down the state, they found 150 more in another cemetery on the border of Pennsylvania. And this continues all the way down through Florida and all the way out to the Catalina Islands in California.
Well, let's talk about this for real quickly, because the book is basically covering quite a bit of America, and it actually goes from east to west. But isn't the greatest concentration in the Mississippi area? This is what it seems to be. Where did you find the greatest concentration?
Well, yeah, I mean, the most amount of finds revolve around the Mississippi River, But once you, you know, I say this to a lot of people. I mean, we tend to divide America up into states, and there'll be fines made in Ohio that are 20 miles from fines made in Indiana, and somehow we think that it's different, you know. But, you know, if you really look at what's going on, these fines pretty much mirror the major river systems and connecting streams and creeks all the way across the country. And the highest concentration of remarkable fines, I would say, would be in Ohio. The Smithsonian's own field reports in West Virginia, where they dug in 1883, they found three giant skeletons, and in their own reports, you know, talk about copper jewelry, copper crowns, mica implements, and the grave goods. I tried to include, you know, I didn't just give the blurb about the skeleton being found. I tried to give the context of where it was found and also what else was found with it. And that's one of the more remarkable things, because the grave goods are so consistent. You find copper in these mounds consistently. You find these unusual burial practices where the giants are in the center, sometimes standing up, surrounded by sentinel stones, sometimes in with a queen laying on top of her, and it just goes on and on and on. And the internal consistencies of it was what really got to me. And then I started saying to myself, well, I mean, where did the copper come from? And that led to the copper mines in northern Michigan, which are extraordinary. And so it was a complex culture, and the dates of go all the way back to 10,000 BC, basically.
That is completely amazing. Would you say that the mound building or the discovery of giant skeletons in mounds is consistent with mound builders? Would you say that they are the ones who built the mounds?
Yes. I mean, that's definitely. The Indian stories that relate to the mounds, they consistently say that we didn't build these things, that there was a race of giants. The fact that the large mounds, when they got inside them, they often had what were almost like temples inside. Houses were, the central burial was a giant. And I'm not saying that the attendant culture were all giants, but clearly the ruling class was, because they're found with crowns, copper jewelry, copper armor, copper. They found them with swords, other implements. So the implication is clearly this was the ruling class.
Okay, and I wonder, is there any documentation that you found that leads one to see where the origination of these people came from, these giants? Are they,
well,
they just appear?
Too. It's
okay.
Worldwide culture, and it's unquestionably true that this evidence has been suppressed internationally, not only in America. There's a lot of reasons, I think, that go into it, but you can see evidence of the mound-building culture in the British Isles and in Europe. Things are coming out of Russia right now that are really amazing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it continues all the way through into Asia.
And
if I like... Yeah.
Do you think that, as some people think, that they could be antediluvial, maybe pre-flood? Of course, if they have dates to 10,000... BC, that's what a lot of scientists would say, 9,500
BC. The cut off the Ice Age and the Great Deluge.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, there's some very interesting things that I'm working on. You know, the connection with the Atlantis and the ANT root words, which include Anu and Tlaxcalan and things like that. In the West, there is the survival stories out there where the Indians say that they went underground to survive a cataclysm with the ant people. And people immediately assume they're talking about ants. But if you take ant, you know, as an antecedent for Atlantis, I mean, there's an obvious connection there. And in the Bible, there's in Numbers, there's a story where they went into a strange land inhabited by giants who they refer to as the sons of Anak. And they said, before them we stood like grasshoppers. So, yeah, there's a clear implication of a pre-diluvial culture. And you have the Nephilim stories, the angels descending on Mount Hermon and mating with women and birthing a race of giants. And you have frost giant stories, you have titans, you know, and
right.
it's clear to me. I used to think this was all just mythology, and I no longer feel that way.
Do you find any influence by, other than the myths, do you find any influence coming out from giant stories? In other words, Native Americans otherwise would talk about, I mean, if this goes back as far back as you say, it would be probably become a myth because nothing was written down, or if it was, it was lost.
Yeah. Well, in the book, you know, there's probably about 10 references across the country to the Indians saying, you know, to in effect that we didn't clear these things, we didn't build these monumental things giants did. And then out west, the Paiute Indians have a survival story about the Sitaka, who were the Thule eaters. And Thule is like papyrus. And out in the west, California, Arizona, Nevada, there was a huge freshwater lake there called Lake Lahontan. And it was destroyed by the Lassen volcano in around 5,000 BC. And the Lenni Lenape Indians say that they, and the Lenni Lenape are associated with giants, and they say that in their distant past history, they used to live out west until there was a cataclysm of fire that drove them to migrate across the Mississippi. And once they crossed the Mississippi, they ran into the ruling giants there, and there was apparently some titanic battles that the Alligway, Menengue, and Lenni Lenape engaged in. And the Lenni Lenape won those battles and eventually ended up on the East Coast from New York, Long Island, Delaware, West Virginia, in that area. So, you know, that's a pretty, you know, complete history from the Indian side. And then the Paiutes say that within their own recent recorded history, the last of the giants were burned out in Lovelock Cave, which is one of the caves associated with Lake Lahontan. And they were digging for bat guano out there around the turn of the century and went down several feet and started to uncover remains, which included giants with red hair and matching totally the Paiute stories related to the Sitaka. So,
fascinating.
Yes.
The mounds are dwellings or burials, but have you found any structural evidence that is giants? Like, I always think of when I go south of the border to Mexico into the Yucatan, there's, you know, whole cities. Have you found evidence of any cities in any of these places that you've referenced?
Probably the biggest and the most amazing one I ran across was in Oklahoma. In Oklahoma, on the Oklahoma-Texas border in there is the what's called the Cato culture. And the Cato culture is associated with the giants by, you know, various references and remains found out there. And Cato Lake is a huge freshwater lake. And then in Texas, there's one of the biggest freshwater aquifers in the country. And in that area, when they were building a dam, they discovered voluminous remains there, and they estimated a city of over 100,000 people, which they destroyed and flooded out. And this has happened maybe four or five times in my research. Significant sites just flooded out with dams. And also out in Oklahoma, they've recently found evidence for what looks like huge forges. So,
what's a forge?
For metal work.
Oh, metal
copper.
Work. Ah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And again, up in Niagara Falls, another city with huge remains, gold and silver work. The thing I found interesting up there is that the Mormon tablets, which have been a source of huge controversy, and generally said that there's no way that there's any evidence for gold working. Well, that city had apparently rods which they identified that they were using for gold and silver work. So down in Alabama, they found their big mound builder sites down there. They estimate there that city could have been 100,000. Poverty Point, which is in Louisiana, again, they estimate could have been 100,000. Cahokia in St. Louis, which they traditionally said was 60,000 people, within the last year or two, they've been doing excavation work in St. Louis and discovered that the site is at least twice as big as they estimated. So another city of 100,000 people.
That's amazing. Let's talk about the size of these people. You have various estimates, or have been provided or researched various estimates. What was the biggest group? I mean, the real giants. I mean, I think there's one place where you estimate a queen was 9 feet tall.
The queen was 8 feet tall. The attendant king that was buried and placed on top of her was 9'2". And there's a picture of her in there, and she's bedecked in copper jewelry. Just astonishing amount of copper jewelry on her. In Ohio, they've found another 8-foot queen with another 9-foot king, and then there was 7 mounds found in conjunction with them, and those skeletons were also 7 to 9 feet. Near the Ohio-Indiana border, I found one story, very well documented, where the whole town went to see it. It was eventually shipped to New York, they said. This skeleton was 18 feet tall, found with a 9-foot sword and an iron helmet that the writers said resembled something from Nineveh. And that 18-footer, that was the biggest one I found that seemed to be a credible find. By and large, the majority of them are 7 to 9 feet, and then there's another range of around 10 to 12 feet.
7 to 9 feet. And so that the average weight of somebody like that is 400, 500 pounds, right?
Could be, yeah.
That'd be a huge person. What is amazing to me, and we're going to talk a little bit about the Smithsonian in a minute, is with all these potential grave sites, why is there not one single piece of skeletal remain in a museum throughout the whole country? That is just, I don't understand that.
Astonishing.
I mean,
yeah, astonishing. The official line is that they don't recognize the validity of the remains under question, which is sort of a scientific way to slam a door. And so traditionally, these accounts are usually isolated, and if there's any pushback on what's been found, they call it a hoax. And, I sort of used to believe, probably got nothing better to do, some farmers put some bones together, but when you start reading account after account after account, it's obvious that these aren't hoaxes. Nobody was profiting from them, And in the 19th century in America, as evidenced by Abraham Lincoln's quote, this was pretty common knowledge. Now, the skeletons that there was four giant skulls held out in Nevada at one of the state museums there, and they were displayed apparently at one time, and then the state of Nevada stepped forward and said they refused to accept their legitimacy and had them withdrawn.
I understand that, yeah.
The findings out in Catalina Island just truly boggle the imagination. Do you want me to get into some of that?
Well, let's talk about that. Megalithic Catalina is the chapter. That, I, of course, as a native Californian, I was a little shocked to hear about that. So let's talk about it. What was discovered in Catalina? And why?
Well,
by the way, why go to Catalina? Why go there? Why did they go there?
Why go there?
Yeah.
Well,
I mean,
again,
why did they begin to dig?
Oh, why did they do it in the beginning?
Yeah.
The Wrigley family basically owned the island and established the Catalina Museum there, I think in 1910 or so, and hired Professor Ralph Glidden to head up the museum as a curator, and they started following legends that there was burials at various parts of the island and surprising giants, so on. So he began in 1919 to dig, and over a period of 11 years, he uncovered one major cemetery there, and he estimated that there was three other ones on the island. The one cemetery that he excavated, he eventually removed 3,781 skeletons, averaging 7 feet, and the tallest was 9'2". Okay. Then he found several thousand more on the adjoining islands, Channel Islands, and he has been demonized as a crackpot. Well, number one, he was the curator of the Catalina Museum, and number two, he was the head of the Hay Foundation, which was officially part of the Smithsonian. Now, in Glidden's case, he began to exhibit the bones and sell them at the gift shop. and there's photos of that. And apparently, the Fowler Museum at UCLA supposedly holds 200 of these skeletons. And they're not talking to anyone. And then the Smithsonian, which I include in the book, has 536 negatives taken by Ralph Glidden of his excavations, which are also restricted access.
So when you say restricted access,
happened in the 20th century. And I lived in Southern California for 25 years. I researched projects about Indians. I never heard a peep about any of this.
It's amazing.
I mean, it was like going down a rabbit hole when I started researching this.
Well, is there any evidence of... I saw the book, but is there any evidence...
There's a Sunday supplement. That was a Sunday supplement, nationally syndicated, front page article. I mean, this was not something that was unknown. And the fact that it could be forgotten about in 30, 40 years is boggles my mind.
What's amazing is that they have thousands of skeletons, and they don't have at least one in on the island's museum or displayed in L.A. somewhere.
Well, and then a couple years ago, the museum changed hands. It's now officially the Catalina Island Museum. The new curator there was doing something about World War II, and he was back in the storage area, and he found several boxes of Glidden's material, and... started to go through them and discovered that there was all this, evidence of the digs and that he was a real archaeologist, that the things had been conducted in a scientific manner. The LA Times and several others picked up on it, ran an article about the whole thing, and not one mention of the skeletons, the extent, the thousands that were found, the unusual size, the fact that there was also a monolithic temple resembling Stonehenge that was apparently also found there. So, again, in the Smithsonian, the UCLA, mum on the subject.
So you basically followed the trail of excavation, and then it basically dies because it's everything is stored away. And would you say the information is suppressed or just not available, or both?
Both. I think, especially, well, this whole thing began with Major John Wesley Powell, who was the first head of ethnology in 1879. Prior to that, the Smithsonian was pretty forthcoming about the mound builders. In the first book they published in 1849 was on mound builder culture in the Mississippi and had incredible illustrations and speculations about where they came from, so on and so forth. When Powell took over, he instituted as his first official act of the Smithsonian the Powell Doctrine, which was a paper called On the Restriction of Certain Forms of Anthropological Data. And in there, he specifically forbade any consideration of pre-Columbian contact, period. And also, he was very adamant about no speculation about lost tribes either. Which I found very interesting because he was from northern New York State and his father was a preacher who lost his flock to the Mormons. So he went out of his way to, you know, specifically forbade that. Now, since a majority of these skeletons, when they found hair on them, are usually red or blonde hair, that opens the door, well, this Caucasian influence is clearly contradictory to the official line. And then when Powell stepped down, this man Arlush Heldrushka took over. And he's the guy that came up with the Bering Land Strait theory that all the American Indians came over from, you know, Asia by way of the Bering Land Strait, and then they all came into the Americas, which is being completely debunked at this point. Even the Smithsonian is starting to back away from that one. But in the book 1491, he estimates in there that Heldrushka himself was responsible for 30,000 skeletons being uncatalogued, crated up, and put away. So even if you went to the Smithsonian, they wouldn't know where they were at this point.
It's funny that you are finding all this evidence for giants in America, and yet no evidence in any textbook or museum or any document, including National Geographic, which a lot of people look towards for their information about history, there's nothing there.
Nothing.
And it makes you wonder if there's some kind of conspiracy, which I hate to get into because I don't want to get into conspiracy. But
you know, it's the big bugaboo word. You know, once you know somebody says, "Oh, it's a conspiracy," the second you know they say that, you know, you're some sort of flake.
Exactly.
But I you know, I have to tell you, I didn't go into this as a conspiracy theorist. You know, it was something that literally just fell out of the sky to me, and the amount of evidence as it began building up over the several years I researched the thing, not only did I feel like I'd fallen down Alice's rabbit hole, but everything I had learned in school, and I took, you know, anthropology, archaeology, I didn't major in it or anything, but, you know, great interest my whole life. And as far as I knew, well, you know, we had Indians and teepees. And occasionally, you know, these big mounds, but with no kind of context or where they came from.
And, yeah, it's just amazing.
And, you know, the Smithsonian just pops up over and over and over again. In San Diego, they found a 9-footer that the Smithsonian bought. In Nevada, there was a sort of funny story in there about a farmer. They don't say exactly how big this thing is, but the Smithsonian sent out a husband and wife team called the Shoops, and they said this thing is of such gigantic size we can't even comprehend it in the human timeline. And they tried to buy it from the guy, and he said no. I'd rather, you know, just keep it here in Nevada. And the couple then rented the camera equipment in town, took pictures of it, disappeared. Then in the 1930s, the Smithsonian was involved with the University of Texas and the WPA, which is the Work Progress Administration. And in Texas, they found what was called the Giant on the Beach. And this was a human skull that Heldruschka himself was down there and said it's the largest human skull ever discovered and raises questions about inhabitation in Texas up to 40 to 50,000 years ago.
Hmm.
And, you know, front page on the Texas newspapers, WPA, University of Texas involved, Smithsonian involved. Did we ever hear about it? No.
Hmm. Is there any present day or the last decade or two discoveries of giants that you have found that have
None.
Been documented?
Hmm. Nope. I mean, to give you an idea how bad it is, again, let's put a couple things in perspective here. The mound builders have no official recognition on part of the federal government vis-a-vis indigenous tribes or anything. And that's because nobody's ever stepped forward and said, I'm a descendant of the mound builder culture, and therefore I demand protection for my, you know, native history. So mm-hmm. that's like problem number one. Problem number two is the NAGPRA laws. And the NAGPRA laws were instituted, NAGPRA stands for Native American Grave Repatriation and Protection Act. And that's a real fancy way of saying that any old bones found anywhere are immediately assigned to the local Indian tribe and reburied.
Mm.
And the legal cases in the last 10 or 20 years revolving around the NAGPRA laws, especially in the case of the Kennewick man, which was up in Washington State, in that case, they were two guys are on the Columbia River after some severe rainstorms watching a boat race, and they saw a skeleton sticking out of the bank there. Reported to the police. Police examined it, determined that it was too old to have been involved in any crime. The local universities got involved. They began preliminary testing of the thing and determined that it was 7,500 years old. The local Indians stepped forward and said, you know, you're desecrating our ancestors. You can't test this. We want it, and we're going to rebury it. And then there was almost 10 years of legal battles, and a bunch of scholars out there got involved and said, you know, we have rights to, and they did chromosome testing on it, and they found that it had what's called Genome X, which is basically a Caucasian marker, and the academics stood forward and said, you know, this has absolutely no relationship to the local Indian tribes.
yeah.
And so we're not getting reports of any skeletons because the second they're discovered, they're reburied because of the NAGPRA laws. Now, to make it even worse, down in Alabama, where there was, as I say, evidence of a city of 100,000 down there and huge mounds, after the book went to press, I saw an article out of Alabama, and this is a huge mound, which I didn't even run across in my research, which was across the street from a Walmart, and the local government was ruling, Walmart wanted to knock the mound down and put in a parking lot. And, you know, the no federal protection. Some local scholars again stepped forward and tried to, you know, voice their displeasure. But there's no protection for these things. None.
So are you saying it was completely flattened and bulldozed over?
As far as I know, that one's still up in the air, you know. But it very, you know, with the amount of with the lack of protection and the economic pressure involved, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if it was bulldozed. But, you know, I mean, there's certainly
amazing.
No national outcry. I mean, I sort of joke. I mean, people say, well, what can you do about it, you know? And I said, well, it'd probably take somebody with some national stature to step forward. And they said, so I said, well, I think Conan O'Brien would be a good one, you know? I said, you know, he's like 6'6", 6'7". He's got red hair, right? And I said, maybe Bill Walton. You know, Bill Walton and Conan O'Brien could step forward and say, we're descendants of the Mound Builders, and we want protection.
Actually, that's quite interesting. Well,
yeah, I mean, that would get their panties in a bunch, you know?
That would stop them for sure. Maybe get something going. Why don't you? Your book is filled with so many examples of giants. Why don't you give me your top three, starting with the most amazing top three finds of giant humans that you discovered?
Well, Catalina Island would have to be head and shoulders number one, just for the sheer volume, the amount of academics involved, the fact that it was national and international news. There's a lot of the finds in Ohio are just extraordinary. Not only are the giants 7 to 9, 10, in some cases 12 feet, a lot of them are found with freshwater pearls. One burial alone had 500,000 freshwater pearls. The mouths of the giant skeletons were stuffed with them. The attendant grave goods, again, included full copper body armor, copper crowns, scepters, swords, just amazing. And then, in addition, in Newark, Ohio, they found incised stones with the Ten Commandments and ritual cleansing bowls, which have been identified to the Second Temple, hieroglyphic writing, et cetera, the finds in West Virginia are quite amazing in the sense that it's the Smithsonian's own field reports that are reporting these giant finds and attendant grave goods. Tennessee and Kentucky, there's huge amounts of these things have been found. Secret caves, sacred springs, walled rolling stones, blonde hair, giant mummies, just goes on and on and on. The finds out in Spirit Cave in Nevada, again, they were doing bat guano excavation. And in this case, they discovered mummified skeletons. Two of them that we can find are 6'2" area. There was a third that disappeared. That was supposed to be around 7.5 feet. The thing amazing there is that they're not only mummified, but they're wrapped in an incredibly fine textile made out of tule reed again. And the tule was used like papyrus and for a wide number of things. And there's a picture of the mummy wrapping in there. And that's 7,500 B.C. Okay?
That's what's amazing. Yeah.
Advanced textile work, 7,500 B.C. in the Americas.
Yeah. You mentioned Ohio. In your book, there is a photo of, you call it, I guess it's titled The Newark Holy Stone.
Right.
Tell us about the Holy Stone. The picture is amazing, and I think I'm going to put it up on the website for people to look at. It's a picture of, I guess, is it Moses in this picture? Is that what they think it is, or are they not
sure?
Well,
yeah. Now, again, you know, this stuff was found in conjunction with giants that, you know, they don't make the association specifically, but, you know, once you put it all together, the same mounds where the giants were coming out of were where they found all of this evidence for contact with the Near East. And, again, the Smithsonian very early on stepped forward and said this stuff is all a hoax. The University of Ohio has subsequently gotten involved and reacquired the stuff. That the material in the book is from their own website, and they say it's unquestionably real. It's got abbreviated Ten Commandments on it, and then there's a ritual cleansing bowl and another artifact, which are unquestionably, according to university, they're real. Up in Iowa, which is on the other side of the Mississippi River, a little north of there, they found another example of hieroglyphic writing. And then there's many finds that have been made in Illinois and Michigan relating to voluminous tablets that resemble the stuff that has been accredited from the Mandan culture. Again, having writing, and Roman coins. And these are again the coins that were found in Kentucky and Tennessee. Oh, the farmers planted them. You know, first of all, there's huge caches of these things, and they're completely weathered, and they're. Again, they've been identified as being authentic. So the amount of pre-Columbian contact is voluminous.
Were you able to find any kind of dating on this? I guess it's a sandstone, holy stone, made out of sandstone. Was there a date given to it?
Again, they can only, because it is stone, they can't really do any kind of complete dating on it, but there is a biblical scholar in there, I think from Herschel Shank's publication, who says that it seems to be identical to Second Temple ritual implements, that weren't known by the academic community until the last 50 years, and this stuff was found prior to that. So the idea of a hoax becomes pretty hard to argue.
Mm-hmm. And Second Temple is approximately what time period?
600 BC to the
600 BC
to the destruction, I think, which was 70 AD around there.
So we're not sure how sophisticated these people are, except you do mention a sun calendar in Lower Mississippi River, which they called Woodhenge. Can you tell us a little bit about that? I find that
Woodhenge
fascinating.
Woodhenge was found in conjunction with the Cahokia, which is the mound in St. Louis. It's the conjunction of three rivers, major river systems there, and it's bigger in volume than the Great Pyramid, and the construction of the Woodhenge is very almost identical to Woodhenge in England. And then you have the potteries that have been found across the America. A lot of the examples that are in there are also associated with the giants in the mound builder sites, and they're clearly of a much higher degree of sophistication than the generally found Indian pottery. I mean, they're really quite beautiful and quite amazingly engineered. Stuff that they found up by the copper mines in northern Michigan, Keweenaw Peninsula, and especially Isle Royale, They've also found evidence of dams up there, irrigation systems. So this is true out west, Mesa Verde, where there's White Sands Missile Range took it over. But again, evidence of a city of 100,000 people, use of cement, irrigation, housing, forges. So we're talking about a material culture that's quite a bit more sophisticated than the American Indian culture that came after it.
Mm-hmm. Have you, and I don't think it's in the book, but maybe it is, and maybe it's coming up. Do you have information that these ancient giants were astronomers and followed the cycles for seasonal farming, agriculture?
Yeah.
Is there a remains?
The mound builder sites, including Cahokia, and some sites that are in the east, seem to have been aligned with the Pleiades, in much the same way that they posit the Orion connection with the Great Pyramids. There's, again, evidence of megalithic solstice markings. New Hampshire, their Mystery Hill site, which is very much resembles the stuff in the British Isles, has solstice markings. Up here in Vermont, there's quite a bit of stuff. Some of it they call a root cellars. Now, it turns out a couple miles from where I live, a guy on his property has one of these things. I went over there, and these were, it was literally a sort of mound covered with dirt with monolithic, you know, huge stones in it with lintels. I went inside the thing. It was over the roof was over 7 feet tall. And a balancing stone behind there. And then supposedly in the valleys associated in this area, especially down in Woodstock, there's even a bigger version of that quote-unquote root cellar. And then in the hills back there, which I haven't been able to go look at yet, there's supposedly remains of, again, observation areas with stones indicating solstices and other alignments.
Interesting. So,
yeah.
That's a key indicator. One of my interests is in ancient machining, and there's a number of engineers that I'm familiar with who have actually shown stone cut in Egypt that were machined. Had to be a power machine.
Well, Brian Forrester and Chris Dunn are doing a lot of very amazing work in that regard, and showing that.
Yeah.
As well as the stuff down in South America.
Exactly. I bring that up because in your book, you show a photo of a stone duck bowl found in Moundsville. And it looks, if it's stone, it looks like it was, part of it was at least cut using some equipment. Now, do you know if anything like that, or any potential machinery was used, or any technology was used on this?
Well, there's no evidence of it, that I know of, but this stuff needs to be studied. Again, out in Catalina, within one of the ritual burials there, which was, there was what they referred to as a 120-pound stone urn that seemed to be machined, and within it was a blonde-haired girl, under that was 64 children, and under that was a giant. They remark again on the amazing quality of workmanship and machining that seems to be in exhibition. And these things pop up all across the country. Also, some of the other pottery that they found has cord markings on it. And cord markings have been found from the Ainu pottery in northern Japan. That's the oldest dated in the world. They've also found cord marking in the British Isles around Stonehenge. And Multiple examples of cord marked pottery in the Americas. So again, we're getting into this, you know, prehistoric, worldwide seafaring culture. And a lot of these stories then all come back to Isle Royale, which is in Lake Superior. And Isle Royale is basically an island made out of the purest copper in the world. And essentially the island was the result of a volcanic upthrust. The sulfur impurities burned off in the air. And that island and the Keweenaw Peninsula, which is what's right underneath it, they found 10,000 years of mining up there. Two University of Michigan guys who wrote a book estimated 1.5 billion tons of copper came out of there over that 8,000 to 10,000 year period. Some of the local people up there have been looking into this quite seriously. Said there's a petroglyph up there of what resembles a ship from Crete. Now, you can account for some of this copper, you know, within the ritualized burials that they found in the mounds, but no way can you account for the huge amount of copper taken out of there, which again raises, you know, the obvious question that this stuff was being shipped and taken over to Europe and who knows where else.
That's fascinating. In any of your studies and uncoverings, did you find any evidence of a migration of giants? And also, when I ask that, it's not just did they migrate from Europe or China or wherever, but in any inception point that any group of giants may have come from, or did it just appear and they've been there for?
Just stuff by inference, like we've been talking about. I mean, clearly, you know, you start putting two and two together, and you can see similarities to finds in Europe and Asia. There's some of the accounts, especially Dr. John Haywood's stuff out of Kentucky and Tennessee. He wrote a report for the State Historical Society, a very detailed one, and not only his own findings, but compiled all of the best stuff that had been found in the 100 years previous to that. And he came across a lot of information that seemed to indicate connections with Scythia and Libya, the tribe of Dan, you know, seems to be a likely source for some of this stuff, you know, the Danube. I mean, it's clearly a river and ocean-going culture. You might call it the seafaring people or whoever, but that we have hardly any knowledge of because there are trade routes, history, and everything else. Number one, they didn't like to write things down. If they did, it was usually in ogham, which looks like scratches to most people. And you get most of our history from, you know, the Near East, Greece, and Rome. And in the case of the Mediterranean was blocked off for over 1,000 years, basically by Phoenician traders who were trying to keep the trade routes secret. So we don't have, you know, in our conventional history, hardly anything about, you know, the people that circumvented the Mediterranean culture, basically.
We only have a few minutes here. I really want to circle back into the history. Would you say that you're angry with what Smithsonian has done and American historians, or are you just perplexed as to why they would cover this information up? Because from what I can see in this book, and this book is basically a reference of all the findings throughout the last 150 years of these giants, it seems to me that there should be some, you know, documentation, museum pieces, some reference to these people. What Why would they, you know, want to cover this up?
Well, I would say the number one reason for the Smithsonian covering it up is the theory of evolution, which basically, as far as man is concerned, has us, you know, rising up from monkeys and getting bigger and smarter. You can't very well teach the theory of evolution with 10 to 12 foot giants.
yeah.
The charts have to be all, you know, all of a sudden you're getting smaller and stupider, right? It's a big monkey wrench. And in the 19th century, when these things were codified, they were priding themselves on scientific objectivity, which meant that anything out of the Bible or myth was looked at as being unacceptable scientific evidence. So I would say that's like a major stumbling block worldwide regarding this information. As to anger, I mean, I sort of went through most of the stages of grieving. You know, when I first saw this, it was like denial and then acceptance, and, you know, then anger, and then, you know, like... At this point, I just hope that the Smithsonian, even if they don't officially, and I know there's people at the Smithsonian right now, a number of them, that aren't buying the party line, and they're trying to push themselves out of these historical cul-de-sacs that they inherited, you know. You know, if the mound builders could get official recognition from the federal government, that would go a huge way. You know, and if by small increments things like my book can start opening doors, then possibly we will start getting access to some of this information.
Mm-hmm.
But right now the academic community is frightened to get near any of it because they're going to lose their funding and accreditation. And if they're young scholars, they will not, you know, be accepted into the academic community. So, mm-hmm. you know, again, it's almost like a religious question. You know, it's like, oh, you believe in giants? Well, you must be crazy.
Exactly. It looks like we have a question here. Let's talk to this individual and see if they have. Hello, hi. Give us your first name and where you're calling from.
Wanda, I'm in Arizona.
Hey, Wanda.
She's in Arizona.
Arizona or yeah. Alabama? Alabama?
Arizona.
Oh, Arizona.
I'm from Mississippi, but I live in Arizona.
Okay.
Yeah, there's a lot of things coming here. I'm coming in late to the conversation, so you might have been over some things that I might be asking, but I think they closed down part of the Grand Canyon. There's a lot of activity going on there. Now, I know we're talking about giants, but I'm hearing that pyramids are coming up, and they've also found a lot of ancient stuff, Egyptian things, around the Grand Canyon.
Right.
But this is what I want to say about the, oh, gosh, I'm sorry, I'm getting brain fart. But the Smithsonian, they're very guilty of getting rid of a lot of historical things. I guess if you really want to find things, you need to look in the Pacific, you know, the Atlantic Ocean, because they're dumping it.
Mm-hmm.
They're dumping
one
these
of the
bodies.
I've heard.
Yes,
so do you have a question
dumping
for
the bodies.
Richard? What is your question?
Oh, I just want to make a comment about this stuff with this.
Well, in the case of the Grand Canyon
before.
And the Smithsonian, again, and I didn't include that story in the book because there was no specific proof of giants, you know, but again, around 1910 or so, a huge article appeared in association with the Smithsonian once again, that they had found evidence of an underground city in the Grand Canyon.
Mm-hmm.
And the people that examined it said there was evidence of Egyptian hieroglyphs and so on and so forth. Again, it coincides with the story out of the area, which the Indians say they went into an underground city with the ant people to ride out the cataclysm. And then, conversely, in Turkey, in the last 50 years, they've discovered in Cappadocia three or four underground cities that were capable of taking up to 30,000 people, rollaway stones, air shafts, granaries, all kinds of things in there. So there's very good evidence that, and also in that area of the Grand Canyon, which is the confluence of the Colorado and Little Colorado River. The actual entrance is probably on the Little Colorado River, and that's the same area where the Indians again say the Sipapu was, which was the entrance point. And then in the area behind Death Valley, they found, and I've reproduced that, interconnecting over 50 interconnecting caves with evidence of underground temples, giants dressed in what they referred to as looking like prehistoric zoot suits, and as well as displays of mammoths, giant sloths, and all kinds of other animals.
Wow.
And
We have a question here on Facebook. Tom in L.A. writes, is there any connection with the Maya that you found or any other known civilizations with these giants?
Well, I'm sort of trying to get that information together, you know, for the second book. There's all kinds mm-hmm. of indications of contact. There's a sort of blue clay that comes out of Georgia, and it turns out that that clay is found extensively used by the Mayans. One of the most interesting things is that the temple complex of the sun and the moon at Teotihuacan in Mexico City, they've now discovered, has huge sheets of mica between the levels of the pyramid, as well as voluminous use of crumbled mica in all the walls. Now, the traditional scholars say that that stuff came out of mines in Brazil, in the middle of the Amazon, when, in fact, the only place that you can find sheet copper is in North Carolina. So, again, you know, we're seeing a truncated version of American history that says no contact. And again, it's this, you know, oh, it's in Mexico. Well, there was no Mexico in America. it was you know, a North American landmass, and we're the ones that keep dividing it up into, you know, bits and pieces. The construction of the Temple of the Pyramid of the Sun resembles in many ways a lot of the engineering aspects in the Four Corners and the Cliff Dwellers. So,
wow.
Yeah.
So there may have been some kind of trade or information exchange at some point.
Well, I'm beginning to think that, for instance, that the Temple of the Sun and the Moon were actually the capital of North America, and that, you know, really this was a contiguous society at one point, you know, antecedent to, you know, recorded history that we have of the area. And also down in Teotihuacan, there, you know, the city that was supposed to be there next to the pyramid complex was a series of three concentric circles that had canals interconnecting, and then the central palace was in the middle. That matches exactly Plato's description of the city of Atlantis. So,
wow.
Whether
let's take one last... yeah. Let's take one last question. We have Sandy emailing a question from Las Vegas. She asks, is there any evidence that the red-haired mummies found in America are connected with the other red-haired mummies that are found in different parts of the world?
Again, nothing definitive, but when you start taking in the bigger picture, it seems ridiculous to assume that red-haired mummies on one side of the Atlantic are somehow different than red-haired mummies on the other side, you know, since the grave goods and a lot of other things and the mound constructions themselves are so similar. But again, you know, you have this demonization of diffusion, you know, that these separated cultures came up with the same ideas independently as part of some process of osmosis, when most likely there was just shared knowledge and trade.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Your book's fascinating. The book's titled The Ancient Giants Who Ruled America, The Missing Skeletons and the Great Smithsonian Cover-Up. What can you tell us anything about your next book? Is your next book kind of a continuation, or you did mention
I'm
you were
trying to put together The Ancient Giants Who Ruled the World, and by implication, I think it's a worldwide culture. Once you put all the stories together, from the Titans in Greece to the Nephilim in the Bible to the Frost Giants, you know, on and on and on. Teotihuacan, which I was just talking about, all the legends say it was built by giants. So,
wow. So that's going to be quite a project. Probably be three times the size.
Yep. The problem.
Do you have a website or a link?
I use Facebook, and you know, I post most of my material and relate it to other archaeological stuff on there. And
okay, and what's your Facebook page? Because what's the title? Is the title of the book?
It's just Richard Dewhurst. Yeah.
Okay. Fantastic. Richard Dewhurst. Okay, we'll make sure to look that up and post it. Richard, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you very much. Your book's fascinating.
Greg Cliff, thank you.
Yeah, thank you very
much.
And
keep your eyes open out there in San Francisco. I'm sure there's giants underneath the sidewalks.
I'll definitely keep my eyes open.
And be careful.
Thank you very much. And so our guest next week is Dr. Robert Schock. And I hope you all listen in. Until next time.